We'll call the next case this morning. It's Bryn Mawr Kier v. Sebelius, case number 12-3678. You can come on up, counsel. We'll just wait till the courtroom clears a bit before beginning. Mr. Silberman.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Silberman. I'm here on behalf of the appellant Bryn Mawr Kier, Incorporated. When we find a fundamental disconnect between the principles that a law is designed to create and the results from the practical application of those laws, the circumstances warrant reevaluating. And this case reveals multiple instances of that happening, each of which warrant further reevaluation in this Court's consideration. The first disconnect relates to the fundamental principles of due process. Bryn Mawr has been harmed as a direct result of the government's conduct, but is being denied its access to due process. The case law shows that to be entitled to due process, Bryn Mawr has to show both reputational injury and a change in its legal status. And in the evaluation performed by the lower court and in the evaluation performed by the government, the focus is solely upon the reputational harm component, and no real analysis is undertaken with regards to the plus portion of the stigma plus analysis. With regards to the stigma, I don't believe it's really in question whether or not there is a stigmatic component to the imposition of these deficiencies and to the publication of this information on the government's website. The conduct fulfills the nature of almost any shaming penalty. It's public and it's widespread. It is designed to encourage good conduct, but also to expose and to shame bad conduct. And the effect of it is lasting. The court below...
Can I ask what remedy you're asking for here?
We'd like our day in court. We'd like the opportunity to have an administrative hearing to challenge the underlying allegations. The original allegation was that a staff member of this facility coerced a resident into sexual intercourse, an allegation that was denied since day one. We've never had an opportunity to challenge that underlying allegation, but the deficiencies related to that have actually been imposed by the government. So we've never had the opportunity to challenge whether this ever took place.
But what was the effect of that? Because no remedy was ordered based on the procedural posture of the case. And so it's...
So the distinction would fall in the distinction between what the government labels as a formal enforcement remedy and then other alternative remedies. There's no doubt that of the formal enforcement remedies that the government identifies, none of them have been imposed. But there's two separate issues. One is whether or not the conduct that results constitutes another alternative remedy, and underlying that is whether or not Bryn Mawr has in fact been harmed. So if we look to moving past just the question of stigma, to what is the actual harm? The harm that results to Bryn Mawr?
Right.
What you have is this. First off, you have the imposition of the actual deficiencies, which takes a facility from being a five-star compliant facility and converts it into a non-compliant facility.
But my understanding is that that rating evaporates or is updated every 3 years. So any deficiencies that are older than 3 years sort of fall by the wayside and are no longer part of the rating.
That relates to the star rating component, but you also have the issue of enhanced penalties that the facility is facing. Anytime a facility has a G-level deficiency imposed, they lose the right to correct a future G-level imposition, G-level penalty. The circumstances that took place here are that a G-level deficiency, well, let's take a step back. Originally, this was being presented as an immediate jeopardy allegation. The facility hotly contested that this allegation ever took place. The government backed off of its position, and an immediate jeopardy would have entitled the facility to due process. The government backed off of that and brought the allegation as a G-level deficiency along with the $200 civil money penalty. That was the remedies that were being threatened. At that time, Bryn Mawr was entitled to an administrative hearing. Bryn Mawr then took the steps that the government felt necessary to correct the violation, even though the entire time it was maintained the violation never took place. And only after that did the government then withdraw the $200 fine and say, you're no longer being harmed, you're no longer entitled to due process. However, the allegations were still imposed. The minute that G-level violation was imposed, Bryn Mawr lost the right to correct the future deficiency, a right that it utilized in this case.
As far as those deficiencies, is there some enhancement that could take place if something else comes up?
Absolutely.
Is that what you're worried about?
Underlying the entire punishment process, there's a broad level of discretion that's given to the government. One of the instructions contained in the state operations manual is to look to a facility's compliance history and to utilize that in determining what the appropriate penalties are moving forward. Now, the government's response to this is, well, if there's a future violation, you'll have due process rights at that time. But the question becomes, where do we draw the line? That future right will not allow Bryn Mawr to challenge the original violation.
Is there a rule against collaterally attacking old deficiencies?
You can attack the impact that the prior violation is having, but you can't attack whether or not it ever took place. So it is possible under the system as it's being applied to have G-level violation after G-level violation after G-level violation imposed against a facility. The facility never has an opportunity to challenge any of the allegations. The government never has an obligation to carry its burden of proof and prove that anything happened, and then all of those can be utilized as the basis to then terminate the facility. Now, this was sort of the building block argument we presented. We aren't suggesting that every single violation warrants the right to an administrative hearing. But once you rise to this level of a G-level violation, there are real consequences. You face enhanced penalties. You lose the right to correct deficiencies. There is an absolute concrete change in legal status. And the court never evaluated this, and the government simply brushes this to the side and says this is really just a question of defamation.
So that history never goes away? Is that what you're worried about?
The history goes away with regards to the star rating, but there is absolutely no limitation to the government's utilization of that to enhance future penalties. The state operations manual doesn't have a...
So it really doesn't go away?
Not for the purposes of enhanced penalties, no. It has a lasting effect. And the problem with this argument that we can argue it later is, in fact, the broad discretion that's given to the government. Because I will speak from experience that if you later make the argument that these prior violations shouldn't be utilized, the government will point to its own regulations that say, well, doesn't the government have broad discretion as to what penalties to impose, and couldn't they impose these without these prior histories? And so it's difficult to discern exactly what the impact will be, but it's designed. The system is designed that prior history should be utilized to enhance future violations. And more than that, the question of a right to a future administrative hearing is irrelevant to whether or not we're being harmed today and whether we're not entitled to due process today.
Well, what is the harm today, given the reality that this star rating is no longer affected because of the three-year time lapse?
I think the circumstances are analogous to the Humphrey case, where to be able to point to a concrete, today we got a $600 increased penalty that we wouldn't have, we can't point to something concrete like that. And the government argues that without showing the harm today, we're not entitled to due process. But if you look at the logic...
Well, I'm talking about mootness. I'm not talking about the question of, you know, whether there's a sufficiently strong reputational interest to entitle you to some level of due process when you elect to file a plan of correction and take that administrative route in light of a notice of deficiency. That's a separate question. I'm talking about a threshold question of mootness. If there's no present live harm because the result of these adjudications being on your record is I mean, there is no result because there's no website giving you a negative rating. What are we here
but
for?
I guess what I'm saying is not only do you have the immediate impact of the negative rating and that lasts for 3 years.
Well, right, but that three-year time period is over. So there, you may have had a live dispute when this case was filed and even when the appeal was taken, but the 3 years have elapsed. And
there's a secondary component to this, and that is the effect that the government has of utilizing these violations, the deficiencies they've imposed, to increase future remedies and to affect future rights. And that's the part that hasn't been...
Is that sufficiently imminent to create a live dispute?
We believe it is, because there's... imagine the following circumstances that I was describing, which is you have violation after violation after violation where there's no due process right, but then those violations are utilized to take one incident... and terminates.
Correction. There is a due process right if you elect to challenge the deficiency. If you elect this other route, it's my understanding, then that...
Is that with regards to the plan of correction?
I mean, isn't that the situation here? Is because you filed a plan of correction, so you took yourself off of the full due process track.
You see, and I would disagree with that, and I think this is one of the perfect examples where we've created and where the recommendation of the Shalala Court creates a fundamental disconnect between what the law is supposed to do and how it's being practically applied. I think we can all agree the design of the Nursing Home Care Act and the regulations at the federal level is to protect residents of long-term care facilities. That is its fundamental purpose. When a plan of correction is being decided whether or not to be presented, this happens within 10 days of a notice of violation, and the facility is being told, regardless of whether or not it believes that a violation occurred, it has a legal obligation to submit a plan of correction.
So you're saying that before that's even shown there's something happened wrong, you have to correct it.
You have to correct it. And there's something fundamentally wrong if the only path to due process for a facility that maintains it did not violate the law is to go out and intentionally violate the law. Refusing to submit a plan of correction violates the law. That is what gives you your right to due process, because the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has the right to terminate you from participating in the program if you refuse to submit a plan of correction. So what you're doing is you're asking a facility to exacerbate the situation.
You're 100% Medicaid, is that right?
Correct.
And I know that it sounds a little onerous, but it sounds like the government's in charge, unfortunately, for you. Maybe that they say, look, you live by the sword, you die by it, so to speak. They put out some what you may think an onerous. Is this caused some decrease in population in the nursing home?
That's a difficult thing. I mean, there have been changes in the census. It's impossible for us to know who went to the Medicare website.
I guess I'd say they lost business because of this.
We would argue that there has been.
Empty beds.
We've never had the opportunity to present any record to that effect. I see that I've entered my rebuttal time. I'm happy to continue addressing questions or...
If you'd like to reserve, that's fine.
I'd like to then. I'll reserve the remainder of the time.
Fine. Thank you.
Good morning. Catherine Beaumont for the Secretary. We had originally indicated that Ms. Welsh, who is arguing more the regulatory aspect of this case, would go first. If it's okay with Your Honors, I'd like to address the due process issue.
That's fine.
Bryn Mawr, in as much as they said in their argument, cannot point to a single concrete example of a benefit loss or a right altered as a result of the deficiencies findings or the rating systems it complains of. And further, what we know is that where a remedy is imposed, a hearing is available. In the Medicaid system, under the federal regulations, as the court pointed out in Columbus Park, there's 15,000 facilities. In 1993, there were 15,000 facilities surveyed at least every 15 months with the possibility of multiple deficiencies and only a 7.3 compliance rate for these facilities. The result they're asking for would be up to 14,000 additional hearings, full hearings per year. And the reason that's not warranted in this case is because participation in Medicaid, even a sanction, was completely not imposed in this case. A constitutional deprivation has to meet the stigma plus test, and Bryn Mawr fails to do that in both their arguments about the stigma and their arguments about the plus. What Bryn Mawr focused mostly on was the plus aspect, how they met the plus aspect. And in arguing that they've met the plus aspect, what they have to show is what this court said in Brown versus City of Michigan, Indiana, which is that they were deprived of a right securely held. In the cases they cite, it's generally a state law that was violated by a certain publication. Bryn Mawr brings up two instances, what we call the double G policy and what they've called the building block policy. Under the double G policy, what they're saying that they lose is that when a G-level deficiency is imposed, it is true that if they submit an acceptable plan of correction, they won't get a full evidentiary hearing. They will get process, but they won't get a full evidentiary hearing on that G-level deprivation.
Does that have to be an admission of the violation? Is that included in admission of the double G, whatever you call it, if they come up with a corrective
The plan of plan? Correction does not include an admission of guilt or liability. However, to be fair, the directions for submitting a plan of correction say that this is not the avenue to contest liability. So technically, the plan of correction shouldn't do either.
Well, you've got to correct something. So and I assume you admit to something, don't you?
And I thought that what the court was asking me is, in that document, do you have to admit that something happened? Presumably, by taking the corrective action, there's an implication that it happened. But it's not a requirement that that be in the plan of correction. Under the double G policy, what Bryn Mawr is complaining that it loses is that in the very next survey, if they get another G rating or higher, they don't have the opportunity to submit a plan of correction. What happens is they would go directly to a hearing if they ask for a hearing. What happens is that the remedies would be directly imposed, and they wouldn't have the opportunity to escape remedies imposed, and they would have the opportunity to go directly to a hearing. What counsel said that was incorrect is there could be G-level finding after G-level finding after G-level finding in a building block analysis. The reason this is wrong is because of what they complain of in the double G policy. The reason that would never happen is because at the second G, at the very next survey, if they get a G-level finding, they would be entitled to a hearing then. So it's not a process thing.
But not on the earlier deficiency, only on the current deficiency.
What the Department of Appeals Board said in the Fort Tryon case is that you get to put on your case that neither the current deficiency nor the previous deficiency existed. So that in that hearing,
so there is an opportunity to collaterally attack the old.
But what the appeals board said is, yes, we would consider both the existence of both deficiencies, and you would be able to argue that the earlier one did not occur. Because of that, the answer is there is a hearing once a remedy is imposed, which is what this case is about. Once a remedy is imposed, therefore, there is a cutoff date to the time that this could affect a facility like Bryn Mawr. And that's one of the overall problems in this case, is that the damages alleged by Bryn Mawr are completely speculative, because what we know is that they complain, for example, of the double G policy, but the double G policy affects the very next survey, which would be at most 15 months later. That time has well elapsed, and they haven't alleged that it actually happened, that they lost the ability to correct deficiencies. What they allege is that it could happen. And similarly, with their theory that as a building block, eventually this could build up to a significant remedy imposed, as the court pointed out, even in the five-star system, these deficiencies have a three-year shelf life, which has already passed. So we know that the period of time that this could have impacted Bryn Mawr has already passed, and there is no argument that it did, only that it could. So the damages alleged are speculative. Moreover, it's not a loss of a right securely held. And the reason that we say this is because this opportunity to correct and submit a plan of correction is discretionary. The Medicaid and CMS and the Medicaid system have the ability, and what it specifically says in the letter to the facility is that they have the ability to impose these remedies at any time. What they're doing is trying to provide a friendly process for the facilities to correct these deficiencies and not face a remedy imposed. Moreover, what Bryn Mawr ignores is that it's not that no process was given. In fact, in this case, in the IDR process, they had a chance to appeal to a neutral fact finder, the Michigan Peer Review Organization, so not the same people that conducted this survey. They submitted a 15-page single-spaced brief, 45 pages of additional exhibits, including their entire internal investigation and statements by their employees. They had that chance to submit everything they needed to in writing. And more than that, the IDR then, the informal dispute resolution process, they then called and also performed a phone interview with regard to these violations. So that it's not that there was no process. The answer is that the process wasn't a hearing.
It's a paper review, apparently.
Paper review process, which this court said in Northlake, that where what you're reviewing is the is survey results, is the impact, is the choices a surveyor made on what evidence to consider, what they didn't consider, who to talk to, who not to talk to. That's easily expressed, is as easily expressed in writing as it would be to have the surveyor cross-examined in front of an ALJ. I see that my time has expired, and we divided the time so that I could cede sufficient time to the state. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll cede the rest of the time to the state.
Thank you, Ms. Beaumont. Now, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of Illinois Department of Public Health Director Hasbrock. Just I'd like to add a couple of points. I'm going to speak primarily about the right to a hearing under the rule, but I'd like to add a couple of points about due process with regard to the state. First of all, all the state did here was to conduct an investigation. And we know from Hanna versus Larch and so on that conducting an investigation in and of itself doesn't constitute the sort of deprivation that triggers the guarantee of due process. So in that regard, their due process with regard to the investigative findings is not at issue. With regard to the stigma plus, and also with regard to stigma, the state did not impose the stigma because it's not our website. We have no control over what CMS puts on its website. And what it doesn't. And third, with regard to Stigma Plus, we didn't do anything that would have been, first of all, we didn't do anything that would be the plus to the stigma. What the plaintiff's complaining about, what the facility is complaining about here in the plus, are effects, collateral effects to the deficiency findings and to the star rating and so on. And those, we again don't have, there's a causation problem. We don't have control over those. Those happen by operation of federal law. So with regard to the due process claim, really against the state, there isn't anything there. It's not triggered, and we didn't do anything. We didn't do anything, the state, the department, that would have deprived the facility of a right to anything. As you know, the counsel for Secretary Sebelius said, you have no right to submit a plan of correction. That's completely at the discretion of the HHS to say we're giving you the opportunity to submit a plan of correction rather than imposing remedies on you and then triggering the right to a hearing.
Just so I can understand the division of authority here between the state and the federal government, mm-hmm. The state essentially operates as the investigatory arm, or does your agency also make the deficiency findings and then forward them on to CMS?
We make the deficiency findings, and we propose remedies.
Okay.
The ultimately, either, as I understand, in this case, the letter says we will recommend these, you know, unless you submit a plan of correction, we're recommending these to CMS. But we, as I understand it, separately may also impose remedies. And then there's also the parallel state system.
Is there a hearing
as well.
If you impose a remedy?
A hearing if you impose,
is there a hearing
if
before
we impose,
you get around to telling them what they have to do to correct the disposition they say they didn't hold?
No, there's no hearing before we send a deficiency letter. But again, that's just an investigation.
Wait. But I took the next step. Mm-hmm. You said that if they do not offer a plan of correction to a thing they didn't think needed corrected, Can you then impose your own plan of correction?
Oh, can we impose our own plan of correction? No, we would impose penalties then, or remedies. We would impose remedies then.
Well, that's a plan of correction, isn't the remedies?
Right. Well, remedies are sort of...
What is the difference between a plan of correction and a plan of remedy?
Right. Well, there's not really...
Answer that. What's the difference?
There's not really a plan of remedy. Remedies include things like civil penalties.
Uh-huh.
They include things like termination.
A remedy is a penalty? If I fine you $100, that corrects the problem?
That doesn't correct the problem.
I'm talking about a plan of correction.
Yes.
They're going to do, stop doing what they're doing.
Correct.
Or what they're going to do to make sure that what they're doing that is wrong doesn't happen again.
Correct.
Okay. If they don't think they're doing anything wrong, do they get a hearing at all?
If they submit a plan of correction?
No.
If they
say there is nothing to correct. Do they get a hearing on that issue?
No.
Why not?
Because there are two choices here. It's similar to a guilty plea, if I may.
Okay.
That what we're saying is we're accusing you of X.
Right. And he says not guilty.
And he says not guilty, and he gets his trial.
He gets his trial?
If you say not guilty, you go to trial. I mean, in the guilty plea context.
No. Well, we're talking about what we're doing in your context.
Right.
If he says we didn't do what you say we do, does he get a hearing on that issue?
Not unless he doesn't submit a plan of correction.
So that there is no way he can defend himself from your accusation except by submitting a plan of correction of something he said that didn't happen.
No. The way to challenge the deficiency finding, there are two ways. One is to not submit a plan of correction,
right,
in which case penalties will be imposed, which triggers the right to a hearing.
If he says, I'm not going to correct it, I'm not going to submit anything, and you then propose a plan, he has the right to a hearing on that issue, on whether or not you are correct. You have to prove what you just said.
Well, in fact...
No. Do you have to prove what you said he did wrong if he says I didn't do anything wrong?
I think the question
is terribly simple. If you accuse him of being not up to snuff, and he says I am up to snuff, does he get a hearing on that issue, and you have to prove what you accused him of?
There is no right to a hearing unless... There,
so the answer is no?
Correct. There is no right unless there's no plan of... Unless.
Gee, that's a turnaround. You told me originally he gets a chance, if he doesn't submit a plan, to a hearing.
Right.
Told me he doesn't get a chance to say that at the hearing you have to prove that what you said was correct.
Oh, I'm sorry. I completely misunderstood your question.
I don't know how. It was fairly simple, I thought.
I apologize.
I accuse you of wrongdoing.
Yes.
You say you didn't do it.
Yes.
Now, you can penalize me if I take a position I didn't do it and I don't do anything. But I don't get a hearing on the issue of whether I did what you said. Is that right?
No. If you say I didn't do it and you refuse to submit a plan of correction, you get a hearing.
Does the hearing involve your requirement that you prove what you said was wrong? I was right. I mean, I really did something wrong.
My understanding of the burden of proof at those hearings, which hasn't come up here, but my understanding of the burden of proof there is that the facility is taking, is accepting federal dollars, and so the facility has to prove its entitlement to those dollars.
The defendant has to prove, the facility has to prove that they are not guilty.
The facility has to prove it's entitled to participate in the program.
The only way they can do that is to prove they're not guilty.
I believe so.
What is it? Real swing around. It makes me nervous, but go ahead.
Unless there are penalties imposed, unless there's, you know, this is basic due process law, is that unless there's a deprivation.
You know, it's an odd thing, but I've been involved in basic due process questions for now about 61 years. And I don't understand a process where somebody in the government accuses you of doing something wrong, and if you say, I did not and don't do anything, you have to prove you did.
Again, I think
do you have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it just to heave it up?
I believe it's just...
Or
you know, 51%. Yes.
Okay.
But this is just...
Well, at least
is,
I know the position of the government.
My understanding is that this is the burden in most federal... If you're seeking or saying you're entitled to federal benefits, you have to prove your entitlement to federal benefits. You just... You know, the government doesn't have to prove you're not entitled to federal benefits that it's giving you. You have to prove that you are entitled to those benefits.
Absent your accusation of the government, you would be entitled to benefits. Is that correct?
Wait, I'm sorry?
If the government did not say he was doing something wrong, he'd be entitled to benefits.
If the facility wasn't doing something wrong, it would be entitled to benefits.
It's do as I say or you don't get the money.
Correct. Exactly.
I withdraw the question. Go ahead.
With regard, I see my time is up, but could I speak just for a moment about the alternative remedy? I apologize for not understanding that question. But with regard to the other alternative remedy, just to say briefly, the rules allow the authorize the department to impose only the six specified remedies, two other remedies, identified remedies, if those are in the plan, in the Medicaid plan, and if those and other alternative remedies, but only if they have been established, and they're established by being in the plan and by satisfying CMS that these are equally effective to the specified identified remedies. And none of the remedies, the other alternative remedies that the facility has identified here, all of which are imposed by the federal government, not by us, either by the federal government in the star rating or by the federal government in the regulatory scheme itself, none of those have been placed in the Medicaid plan, the state's Medicaid plan, or has CMS been satisfied? I mean, there's no evidence, at least in the record, on that.
What is the share, if I just, this is a side point, what's the percentage share of federal and state as far as money is concerned?
In Medicaid?
Yes, in Medicaid for nursing home. 50-50?
It has been 50-50. I don't know for sure.
I'm just curious. I can send
you a letter.
No, that's all. That's enough.
Just quickly on the question of mootness here, do these deficiencies, once imposed, even without a remedy, because there's been a corrective plan that's acceptable, filed, do they remain on the facility's permanent record, for lack of a better term?
With the state, are you asking?
Well, right, because since you represent the state, why don't you tell me that much? Or do we have a mootness problem here, that there isn't any remedy that we can order?
Right. To my knowledge, I mean, I went on the website, and our website, and looked up the facility, and I didn't see any mention of this. So as far as I know, this, you know, the sort of publicized aspect of this, if there were any stigma, again, they don't say we have stigmatized, the state has stigmatized them, but to that extent, as far as I know, the publication effects are gone, and as far as I know, there's no collateral consequence to them that the state would impose.
What about this use of the prior deficiency to enhance a future penalty?
Well, I think as the United States Secretary Sebelius's attorney said, I think that that's really a misunderstanding of how it works, of how this, you know, how the GG, double G system actually works.
It can actually be reopened if there's a future enhancement.
Is that what you're asking? Yes. No, exactly. That's exactly what happens, that you have the right to bring back, if the government is saying we're intending to enhance the penalty, or even if they don't, you know, if you understand that the prospect is there, you have the right, under the case that, you know, the counsel just cited, the DAB order, you have the right to collaterally attack the prior deficiency finding. Yes.
So that would get folded into the hearing that you get if remedies are imposed.
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
If there are no more questions,
thank you.
We ask that the court affirm.
Mr. Silberman. You've got 3 minutes left.
I will do everything I can. I'm going to go through a couple of the points the court raised. The court asked the question of did the deficiencies go away, and the answer is no.
They're removed from the website.
Removed from the website, and I don't mean to introduce outside, but as former Deputy General Counsel for the Department of Public Health, I can assure you they're always there as part of the record and their government reports that show a facility's full compliance history.
Okay.
And to say that the idea that a prior history is limited in its use is simply incorrect. It is designed, and the government instructs itself, its surveyors, and the state to utilize a prior compliance history to determine future penalties. So that is a harm that never goes away.
Isn't this the due process that's available at that point sufficient?
It isn't for two reasons. The idea of there's one flaw with the double G analogy that went forward. The suggestion was that you have another G, it's imposed, and you're entitled to a hearing. You're entitled to a hearing until the government decides again to waive its $200 fine, and now you're no longer entitled to a hearing. And the next time they impose a G and they decide to give up their $200 fine, you're no longer entitled to a hearing. If the court looks at the circumstances when Bryn Mawr made the determination of whether or not to submit a plan of correction, because that seems to be an issue, it was facing remedies that entitled it to an administrative hearing. At that time, it made the determination to submit a plan of correction. Why? Because it's in the best interests of the residents it serves. Is there any logic to the idea that even if you believe that you didn't do anything wrong, you shouldn't take steps that can only benefit your residents, that you should risk jeopardizing the residents to ensure you have access to due process? And to address Your Honor's point, the practical reality of what happens when you refuse to submit a plan of correction is the government imposes a plan of correction on you, not only goes forward with the remedies it was currently seeking, but now seeks to terminate you from participation in the program because of your participation, your refusal to submit a plan of correction. So you've taken a circumstance where the penalties you're facing entitle you to due process. It's only a $200 fine, but the government is saying, if you want to make sure you don't lose that right to due process, take the situation, make it worse, and jeopardize the welfare of your residents. That is an absurd result when you consider the principles that this law is designed to protect. Now, this argument that the state and the government and the federal government are completely separate players holds no merit. The state is acting as an agent for the federal government. And if we are going to look at some distinction in how the state acts, I think the most telling thing, a factual issue that we've never had the opportunity to explore, is how when the state of Illinois, acting on behalf of the federal government, concluded that these circumstances warranted the imposition of these deficiencies and concluded that the facility had violated federal regulations, but when performing the exact same evaluation on behalf of the state of Illinois from an almost identical regulation, concluded that the complaint was invalid and there was no substantial evidence to uphold the exact same violation. The state of Illinois concluded that no state laws were violated, but federal laws were, based on the exact same investigation. So there's a factual issue that we've never even had the opportunity to explore. Returning to the threshold question, though, is there is no requirement that there be a concrete legal harm. The requirement of the court in Paul versus Davis was either an alteration or an extinction of a legal right. And in this case, we have both. The extinction is the right to correct a future remedy. The government suggested you'll have the opportunity to have a challenge down the road, but the answer is maybe. And the alteration is that we are going to consistently face, to the discretion of the government, enhanced penalties because of these violations. The other thing that the court can realize when it looks at the Humphreys decision, the Humphreys decision didn't require the actual concrete harm. It was enough to the Ninth Circuit to realize the risk of it. The example, and I think it applies amazingly well to this, was that as a practical matter, the law had created a framework under which agencies reflexively checked the stigmatizing listing, whether by internal regulation or custom. That was enough. The idea that they were looking at this index of child abusers to determine what next steps to take. Here, when you look at the stigmatizing five-star rating, the government compare, the government's argument is we're only doing this to fulfill our statutory obligation. The statutory obligation is to make the information available. There is zero obligation to perform a qualitative analysis comparing facilities. And the situation is set up where the government has mandated that its state agencies evaluate a prior history and the information available on the Nursing Home Compare website before they decide what penalties. And they have designed this system so that the public should go look at this in making a determination. It's the exact scenario that the court faced in Humphreys. We would therefore ask you to remand and to provide us an opportunity and access to due process.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Silverman.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilmot, Ms. Welsh, thank you for your arguments. The case is taken.